Hello and welcome to another episode of The Capitol Record. I am your host, David Bonson, and I am very excited to welcome a new first-time guest to Capitol Record this week, that guest being Peter DeSilva, who is the author of the brand new book, number one seller on Amazon in management leadership category. His book is called Taking Stock, 10 Life and Leadership Principles from My Seat at the Table. And I have gotten to know Peter over the last several months. We share a number of, shall we say, commonalities. First of all, Peter was involved in the financial services industry, the wealth management space that I work. He more on the custody side. He'd been president of Scottrade, which many of you may be familiar with, was the chairman and CEO of UMB Financial Corp, and then ultimately became the president of TD Ameritrade and helped oversee that acquisition to Charles Schwab. And so TD Ameritrade has been acquired by Charles Schwab, and Peter has been at the front lines of a number of these very significant M&A activities and been a senior leader in the corporate space for a long time and has a lot to say, has some wonderful insights to share, has done so with his new book. So I thought it'd be fun to bring him on, share a few of the insights from the book and just have him talk a little bit about what he sees as the state of corporate America, what's going on across the marketplace, and hopefully we'll find some things that you'll take away and benefit from. Let me bring on here our first-time guest, Peter DeSilva. So with that said, allow me to bring on a first-time guest to Capitol Record and a brand new author. Very excited to have with us today, Peter DeSilva. Peter, welcome to National Review's Capitol Record.
Thanks, David. It's great to be with you today.
Well, I know that the big release week and all the fun of having a book come out is here, and hopefully you're pleased with the moment arriving. As a fellow author, I know how it feels to finally see, you know, the book out and so forth. Tell our listeners a little bit about the book, what it is, and kind of your story in writing it.
Sure. Thanks for the opportunity to do that. So, you know, the book is called Taking Stock, 10 Life and Leadership Lessons from My Seat at the Table. And it really chronicles the last 35 years or so of my career and the 61 years of my life. I set out to write Taking Stock to really help others learn from the 10 leadership principles that I have espoused in the book. And these are real world leadership principles. These come from 35 years on the front line in business. You know, I was an executive at TD Ameritrade and Scottrade and UMB Financial Corp and Fidelity Investments over the last number of years. So these are real world, practical and actionable principles and strategies that others can employ to hopefully accelerate their growth and their development.
Well, you know, I think that when one wants to learn practical lessons in business, it does generally behoove them to learn these things from someone who's been in business. And I love the idea of people on the executive front lines sharing their experiences and lessons, particularly when it comes to younger people, entrepreneurs, those entering the business world that might only have learned things so far from a professor or an academic who may have words of wisdom to share. They may have words of, shall we say, not wisdom to share, but they may not in either situation have experience to share. So the experiential element is an exciting part of the book. I wonder if you could maybe take one of these major principles and elaborate a little bit with us.
Sure, happy to do that. You know, I'll pick one about leading by principles and not by rules. And so if you think about history and you think about the 282 rules that were in the Code of Hammurabi, you know, from way back in BC, it basically was very prescriptive, right? It said, if you do this, this will be the outcome or the issue. I took a very different approach, which was, you know, it's leadership is about providing the guideposts and the framework within which others can act. It's not about telling people what to do. It's about, again, finding ways to provide perspective and context for action, not specific action. So I spend a lot of time in the book talking about the difference between principles and rules. And I'll contrast the Code of Hammurabi, which was clearly rules-based, with our own Declaration of Independence, which was a set of principles that were enumerated, right? So all men are created equal. It didn't go on then to list 10,000 meanings of that. You knew what that meant, right? It said what it meant, and it meant what it said. All men are created equal. And so, again, I've tried to lead that way in my life and in my business career, whereby you set the context for action and you're not too prescriptive in terms of how that actually unfolds.
In a real life setting, is the idea there that the lowest level of employees can interpret what the rules mean from the principles that the top will help set and carry out? Or is there a middle management tier that then has some flexibility in how they implement? How do you see that, especially in some of the large corporations that you've had executive positions at, that there is such a high number of people that invites complexity in applying these different principles? Where do the rules get set? By the lowest level of people choosing for themselves, or somewhere in the middle levels?
Yeah, it's an excellent question. And so if you just start with this idea that every person, I had 5,000 people at Ameritrade, every one of those folks knew the principles by which we were going to act and we were going to make decisions. That didn't preclude us from having to have, I wouldn't even call them rules, but I would call them guidelines down lower in the organization, right? So you have the principles, which are broad statements of intent. They're broad parameters within which you want everyone to work. And then certainly as you work down, I wouldn't again call them rules per se, but there are some elements that have to be understood and have to be followed for sure. Otherwise, you would have chaos. But all of them are in the context of the principles that were set. So again, you might say a principle might be that we're going to treat every client ethically, as an example. Right? That could be a broad statement or principle. How that manifests itself in specific action and in specific circumstances, I'll leave to their interpretation to some degree, but that principle sort of sets the framework within which we make those decisions.
Do you differentiate, Peter, between rules and then things like processes and procedures? I mean, I would think most processes and procedures also flow from principles, but it seems that there needs to be a little less flexibility sometimes for a protocol, an operational protocol, let's say, versus labeling it a rule and thinking of it legalistically. And I say this as someone who leads a business with 55 people at current. Now we've grown from 8 to 15 to 20 and up to 55. And so I've had different tiers of being real small to still small to medium to where we are. But at 5,000, I just have to think that there is some uniformity that is really needed from a procedural standpoint. And yet I can tell that you have a principle that sort of wants to avoid an overly legalistic setting. How do you think about that distinction?
Yeah, I think you made the distinction that I was trying to make earlier, in the sense that a process or a procedure by definition has to be standardized and repeatable, right? So if you're going to be in risk management, as an example, you don't want to be SVB, which didn't seem to have any ALCO strategy. But you do need to have things that are repeatable. And so whether that's a rule or not, I would argue, but I do think that is a process and that is a procedure. And oh, by the way, you have checks and balances against those as well, right? You want to make sure that those processes and procedures are actually functioning as intended. And so you have the right measurement mechanisms in place to ensure that. But again, I would say that all of that fits under this idea that you can lead in a very, very principled way, and that will cascade all the way down from top to bottom. Within that, sure, there are going to be processes, procedures, and things that have to be followed, either because of regulatory compliance, legal and risk practices, et cetera.
Well, I would think that one of the principles somebody like you would value is accountability, and you know, people being held accountable for the productivity of their work, results. And yet I wonder, even if it veers a little outside the specific things you talk about in the book, just using your own kind of executive experience and your analysis of the current landscape, what you think about the way in which employees today view accountability. It seems to me that there is a high regard for individual autonomy and a low regard for accountability, and a lot of people who want to be very comfortable doing things their own way without necessarily having someone over their shoulder, and including up to the point, as we've seen in this sort of work from home fad that I'm quite publicly and privately critical of, that came out of COVID, this idea of almost kind of entitlement that, you know, I can do my own thing and I'll get my work done and you don't need to worry about it. Just trust me, I'm getting it done. Apart from oversight, apart from collaboration, is this a trend that concerns you? Does it strike you as something very different than you observed in some of your past executive experiences?
Well, you know, I don't think they're mutually exclusive. This would be my first point, right? I think accountability is at the root of leadership. It's at the root of management. It's at the root of everything. You have to be accountable for what it is that you're accountable for. I mean, just simply stated. I don't think that's changing, quite honestly. I do think there is this desire for autonomy. There is this desire for independence, which candidly, David, worries me, in the sense that I see people working less successfully in teams. I see, you know, when people are working together today, they're not clear exactly about what measurable outcomes it is they're trying to achieve. So they shouldn't be mutually exclusive, but I agree with you. There's some tension right now, in part driven, I think, by the distance that's created from working from home, where people are feeling like, yeah, I'm pretty independent, but they're accountable. They have to be accountable as well. And by the way, they're not just accountable to themselves. They're accountable to the team that they work with. They're accountable to the organization that they're part of. And so that accountability extends broadly and widely. And I don't think young people today don't understand that they're accountable. I think they understand they're accountable. But quite honestly, I think it's up to leadership to make sure that the right measures are in place, the right goals are in place, the right review processes are in place to ensure that accountability.
Yeah, I've noticed in particularly out of some of the kind of woke trends of the day and some of these various elements around ESG and DEI and so forth, and it may be more particular in some industries than others. I don't run into it as much in finance, and I don't know what your experience was. We see a lot more of it in media, but what I'm referring to is the C-suite being really afraid of their 25-year-old employees, that there's a lot of culture and values being set implicitly by the youngest of employees because some of the more senior people are really afraid of what backlash they'll get. And there's certain high-profile examples that played out even in the public, you know, the New York Times getting backlash for publishing an op-ed and their senior people firing key writers over stuff that offended a junior person in the newsroom. But even stuff at Netflix we've seen in technology, streaming. I wonder if you think that the old school, you know, we talked about like guys like Jamie Dimon at JP Morgan, David Solly at Goldman. Look, I'm not at their generation, but I'm not one younger either. I'm getting close to 50. I know where you are in your life and career. Is there something to be said for the old school approach that although it got accused of being too authoritarian at times, it got accused of being too rigid, that maybe it was a little better for instilling these disciplines and maintaining some of that necessary order and hierarchy in a company? You know, in your wisdom, how would you unpack some of these tensions?
Yeah, it's a difficult question in this environment. But my first comment would be that leaders can't abdicate their responsibility. And fundamentally, their responsibility is to lead. And they need to make the decisions for their organization with lots of input and lots of understanding of both the external environment and the internal environment and the nature of the workforce that they're leading, et cetera. But I think leaders are almost abdicating today, and they're allowing sort of the pyramid to be turned upside down. And that doesn't suggest to me that, or I don't want to suggest that, you know, the front line doesn't have a lot of valuable things to suggest to leadership. Absolutely, 100%. And I myself describe myself as a humble servant leader, which basically means I serve the front line, not the other way, not the way, the other way around. That having been said, I think it's important that leaders build an organizational construct that allows for expression, allows for these sorts of new ideas to find their way through it. But ultimately, decisions have to be made in the context of we are running a business after all. We have a profit motive as a goal. We certainly want to have an environment that's very conducive for our associates and our clients, and we'll do everything in that regard to create it. But if something's just not good for the organization, then it shouldn't be done. It shouldn't be allowed to fester, if you will.
So you said something a moment ago that I assume you take for granted, and you should take for granted, and you know I take for granted, but I'm not sure that some of these frontline folks that we're talking about do take for granted, and that is the profit motive. You know, the fact that the sustainability of the business requires a certain regard for earnings expectations, for you know, what the kind of economic realities of the various stakeholders and prominent among them, the actual owners of the business need, desire, deserve, require, et cetera. Is that a new challenge for those of us in free enterprise, that some of the people who show up to work do not accept the validity of the very objective of the business to be a profit-making institution?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I would argue that it's our job to educate, because I do think that some come into the environment today and don't have that as a primary objective. It's a secondary or tertiary objective, and it has to be primary, because, as you know, David, if that doesn't work, we don't exist. The organization doesn't exist. The organization goes away. The folks who risk their capital are going to withdraw that capital. We see what happens in the banking industry all the time. Right? When there's some issue, the capital just gets withdrawn. And we've certainly seen that here just in the last few weeks. So I think it's incumbent upon leaders to educate their associates and their teammates that, look, you know, this starts and ends with the profit motive. If we don't have that within a free enterprise system, capital will go somewhere else.
Well, and I guess that fact used to be taken for granted. And now I think you're right. It does require a bit of education. I think, you know, things like this podcast, media enterprises like National Review, hopefully various schools, I would love to think colleges, I would love to think mom and dad, you know, there's a lot of people that bear that responsibility of educating someone who will be a young adult that, you know, the business you work for that signed your paycheck has a certain grown-up realities around the profit motive. But it's tough if you're right that the business leaders have that responsibility. I'd like to think that executives need to prepare managers, and managers need to prepare workers, and workers need to be trained with subject matter expertise and work ethic and culture and discipline for what they're doing. But it just strikes me as a pretty tall order if we also have to add to the list that we need to educate like a grown adult about how the world works.
Yeah, I hear you. And I think the way I think about it is, I think most people understand that there's a need for profits, right? The question is, what's the right need for profits? What's the right profit level that balances all the various constituencies? And in this day of stakeholder capital versus sort of shareholder capital, or you and I were brought up on, there is that question, I think. Have we shared enough? And with our friends at the Business Roundtable recently redefined the purpose of a corporation, in part, I think, because of this recognition that they wanted to make sure that all stakeholders were equally taken care of. And then if profits are left, great. It's not how I think about it. There has to be profit so that I can take care of these other stakeholders, as opposed to starting with the stakeholders and ending up with whatever profits left over.
Right. And you know, I don't want to take us down this tangent entirely, although I love the subject, and I'm sure you and I could talk about it. I also think part of the problem, and maybe this is an opportunity, you know, for training in the workforce, is that the presumption that the profits are for the stakeholders, but and then, you know, we'll figure out how we take care of the rest, as opposed to realizing that us as shareholders, those people who are entitled to some form of profits, that we benefit when we take care of our employees and our vendors, and when we have a culture that people want to come work at, and when you know, counterparties enjoy doing business with us. That's, to me, one of the real sad things in the ignorance about markets, ignorance about free enterprise that the Business Roundtable has facilitated, is it acts as if in the profit motive, these people are opposed to one another instead of in a cycle of mutual cooperation. And that's the thing I would love for younger people to come into a career having a better understanding of.
You're 100% correct, right? There has to be mutual cooperation. There has to be, you know, an understanding and a give and take between all the various stakeholders. But it has to start with an understanding that if this company isn't successful, at least in one part defined as we can make enough money, we can have returns that will draw capital to us and not repel it from us. You know, you have to start there with some of the most basic elements. You know, one of the things I used to do at many of my companies was teach our associates about how we made money. It was very important because they didn't quite understand, you know, maybe at Fidelity Investments that we get management fees, we have trading revenue, we have spread on deposits or whatever those sources of revenue were. Candidly, we started there and said, here's how we actually make money in the marketplace with and from our clients. And then, of course, that fed back into a better understanding of how those profits were reinvested into the business and such.
Well, because you did spend your career in capital markets and particularly engaged in different aspects of the custody business, and this podcast exists to defend capital markets, to hold capital markets up as a vital part of the free enterprise system. I wonder if you could comment a little bit about not just the broader management principles that your book is about, leadership principles, but specific within our industry, Peter. Do you see positive trends as it pertains to the wealth management space, to asset custody versus advice? Do you think investors are in a better or worse position these days as it pertains to execution, as it pertains to objectivity of advice, conflict-free? We hear all the time about things that people think are going wrong and new SEC investigations and concerns, but do you think some things have gotten a lot better since your career started?
Oh, for sure. You know, over the past 35 years, I can give you a couple of examples. One, the transparency of information, right? Information today is ubiquitous. Back then, 30, 35 years ago, you know, there were a couple of players and those players held everything close to the vest and there was no internet and such. So just the availability and the ubiquitous nature of information makes investors smarter and makes them certainly more capable. I remember the old days, you know, when Scottrade and companies like that would hold seminars. You remember, right? The way to educate your clients was to hold a seminar on a topic or whatever it might be. Today, that's all driven digitally, and I think that's a big enhancement over where we used to be. Things like execution, for sure, trade execution today is it's still imperfect at some level, but it is so much more transparent. I mean, how do you go from $200 commissions in the old days of Mother Merrill to today at zero commissions? You get there because of efficiency. You get there because of transparency. You get there because of competition, right, in the marketplace. And so from that perspective, from a pricing perspective, I mean, investors are so much better off today than they were many years ago. This idea of advice, you know, there's digital advice today, which didn't exist even 10 or so years ago. The cost of advisory services today continues to go down, and the benefits continue to escalate. So yeah, absolutely positively over the last 30, 35 years, investors are in a better place today. Even investors without a lot of money, I mean, somebody who's got $20,000 to invest has choice that they didn't have before, has access to information they didn't have before. So I would say up and down the wealth spectrum, everyone is in a much better place.
Well, it strikes me that of all the things you've said and those various advancements and illustrations of progress in the business over the 3 or 4 decades you're talking about, that almost none of them came from regulation or state intervention. That they all are mostly evolutions of the marketplace, of just improvements in the enterprise by which customers are served. Is it possible that we'll look back one day as this being an example of where laissez-faire worked really well, and the industry was able to over time constantly develop, enhance, and improve a model that was more client friendly?
Yeah, I think for sure, right? So innovation is what drives all this. And we all know government doesn't drive innovation. If anything, they can stifle innovation. And so I think if you start with the premise that we're going to innovate our way out of almost any problem that we have, and I think this industry has been particularly good about innovating over time, then I think we can accomplish, you know, wonderful, wonderful things. This industry today is probably 10 times the size that it was. It's 10 times the 10 times more transparent than it used to be. And I think we have done a remarkable job because the free market system enables us, and the profit motive enables us, and competition enables us or requires us to be better. And if we're not better, we're going to get left behind.
And so I assume that that's something you would apply to any industry, just sort of any business, not merely the industry that you came out of. So many of these business principles we're talking about are universal, far-reaching, much like the intent of your book. Do you mind grabbing another one of the principles and sharing?
Yeah, I mean, we can talk about, let's see, which one do I want to pick on here? How about building relationships? This is something that is so important today in the sense that, you know, we all went to our homes during the pandemic, and I think we forgot that human contact matters. I think we forgot that the idea that a young executive, part of the reason they get ahead is they build relationships inside a company. I've heard Jamie Dimon talk about this recently. I hear Elon Musk talk about this. I've even heard Mark Zuckerberg say that we need people back in the office because our culture is suffering, because we aren't working as well together. And I would argue that the basic reason is because we don't have the kinds of relationships with each other that we need in order to affect the business in the way that we want to affect the business. So building enduring, mutually beneficial relationships, I have found in my life to be one of the most important elements of my personal and professional success.
Well, I mean, it's such a profoundly important topic, and one that I don't think gets covered well enough. Is that relational area one you think is getting better or worse across the business landscape?
I think it's struggling right now. I think that relationships are viewed transactionally versus long-term. And so we all have transactional relationships. You can go to the grocery store and have a wonderful chat with the cashier, and then you move on. But what good is that? In a business context, that's not going to lead to a lot of success, quite honestly. So you can have transactional relationships on one end, and you can have true long-term mutually beneficial relationships on the other. Unfortunately, I see us moving to the left more and more towards these transactional types of relationships. Part of it is people turn over at jobs quite frequently now, right? Used to be you went for work for a company, you built relationships, you stayed there, you got a pension, and you moved on. That's just not the case today. I'll tell you a little story. So I was at Ameritrade during the pandemic, and we had to hire thousands of people. The business was booming. Meme stock trading was booming. It was just very difficult to keep up with client demand. So we had to hire thousands of associates to take phone calls and handle transactions for our clients. So we hired them all virtually. And guess what? Within 6 months, the attrition rate on that cohort was much, much, much higher than the attrition rate on the folks we had hired pre-pandemic. So I asked our HR team to do a little analysis and help me understand why we're seeing this group over attrit. And what they came back was, wasn't surprising in the end, but it was eye-opening. And what they said was, I've never met my manager face-to-face. I've never stepped foot in your offices. I've never been out to dinner or lunch or breakfast with the team. It's all been done virtually from my basement. And what they were really saying was they lacked two things. They lacked attachment to our culture, and they lacked attachment to each other. And that's relationships. And I found that very insightful for me as I began to think through, how the heck are we going to manage thousands of people remotely in the context of this idea that they don't connect to the culture and they don't connect to the relationships. So try as we might, and we did lots of things, those were barriers that were very, very hard to overcome.
I think that you very possibly exited the world of the C-suite just in time to avoid what may be the most obnoxious of eras around HR and around just some of the various politically correct pressures that exist. And I equate ESG and DEI for a reason, because I think that some of the ESG pressures, even though it may not be internal human resource conflict, they are more or less external pressures from activists or lobbyists or other people that have a particular agenda that they want to see the company interact with. Do you think that on this HR front and within the workplace, do you have concerns about the future of corporate America, that people's ability to be themselves, to be relaxed, to have authentic relationships without being afraid of what they're going to say and getting pulled in front of the HR Gestapo? I wonder if that's an understated problem in this relationship building you're talking about, that some people are a little afraid to be too candid. And I'm not advocating for an era where people were so loose and comfortable that there was inappropriate behavior or thing. Obviously, we know where the extremes can be that I don't think any decent person could possibly defend or support. But I mean, as the pendulum swung to the other way in such a manner that if you were still in the C-suite, it would concern you for the health of the organization.
Yeah, I think it's a revolution, but it should be handled as an evolution. And what's happened is in the last 2-3 years, we've seen what should take a decade or more of thoughtful reflection to move organizations forward from these practices standpoint. It's just all been accelerated. And in part, there's a whole bunch of reasons, but in part it's because, you know, we've been through this period where the employee sort of got the upper hand over management, right? We've had low unemployment rates for a long, long, long time. Employees have sort of ruled the roost, if you will. And that is going to come back. That is going to swing back. We're already seeing it with work from home. More and more CEOs are saying, look, enough of this. There's a balance. 2 days, fine. Monday, Friday may be okay. But I go back to, you have to have culture in order to, you know, build a successful organization. You have to have relationships in order to work successfully together as a team. And without those things, ultimately, I think organizations will fail or at least falter. So I think it's, you know, maybe the pendulum went a little too far, but I think there were reasons in large part, the pandemic, the shortage of labor, et cetera. And I think it will swing back. And I think it just needs to swing back and be much more kind of in this equilibrium zone.
Yeah. Well, tell me what, just kind of biographically or personally, a successful career, being a part of a number of significant transactions, most recently this acquisition of TD Ameritrade with Charles Schwab, and now they're in the midst of a really, really complex and significant integration. And so going through a number of the really tremendous deals that you were a part of, and now having left that, what gives you the desire to write the book? What gives you desire to come talk to this podcast, for example? Is there a particular burden you feel for corporate America? Tell me kind of what's on your mind and heart that fires you up about some of this stuff.
Yeah, you know, the inspiration to write the book was really trying to help other leaders accelerate their learning so they don't make the same mistakes that I might have made as I was coming up during my career. I had a desire to sort of codify these 10 things that I think have helped me in my career, and I hope will help others. I also had this desire to share these experiences. so that others could accelerate their learning. Not everyone will agree, probably, with my positions in the book, and that's okay. I'm really looking for a dialogue. I'm really looking to contribute to the discussion of what makes a strong ethical moral leader. God knows we need more and more of those in today's day and age, both in politics and in business. And so it really was just a desire to participate in the dialogue, put these ideas out there and start a conversation.
Well, I'm really hopeful that it will start a conversation. I have read through it extensively and I'm really quite pleased with not only the depth and I think the wisdom of the lessons and principles themselves, Peter, but the succinctness, the brevity, the simplicity. Like it's not something that I think people struggle to be able to digest, but at the same time, I think there's a lot of meaning behind them. And I'm hoping the book will get a great audience for that reason. I think that, as I mentioned earlier, there's just really something to be said for learning some of these things from people who have been there. And I think that experiential element adds a lot to it. So I'm really hopeful that the book will bear great fruit and wish you all the best in that effort as you're out pushing the book and sharing the message.
Well, thank you, David. This is truly leadership from the front lines. That's what this is.
I love it. Well, I hope you will join us again on Capitol Record. I appreciate you being here and we wish you best of luck with the book. We'll put the link in the show notes and really ask everyone to go pick it up. But once again, why don't you, with your voice, share the name of the book so they know where to go on Amazon when they go buy it right now.
Yeah, the book is on Amazon, Apple Books, BarnesandNoble.com, and pretty much every other distribution outlet. And it is called Taking Stock, 10 Life and Leadership Principles from My Seat at the Table.
Thanks so much, Peter. Thank you for being here on Capitol Record.
Thank you, David.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that talk with Peter. I hope you'll consider picking up his book and hope that there are some insights from the discussion that you can think deeper about. I not only do find a lot of wisdom in the lessons he talked about, but I think the broader experience and just thought about the state of affairs we have right now in corporate America, it's true with a company with 5 employees, a company like mine with just over 50, or a company like his that had thousands and thousands. There is a shared sort of generational and cultural set of tensions that are going to be resolved one way or the other. And I'd love for those who listen to Capitol Record to be at the front lines of solving these things, that we have wisdom in the way we go about dealing with these tensions that exist, that we not capitulate to forces of immaturity, that we not capitulate to forces of ignorance that refuse to understand the profit motive, capitulate to forces of political correctness that impose upon us this ESG and DIE nightmare, but rather integrate concepts of accountability, wisdom, ambition, aspiration into the marketplace, into the C-suite, all the way down to the front lines. That's what Peter's book's about. That's what Capitol Record's about. That's what National Review's about. And I'll tell you what, if enough people are about all that, then we will have a free and virtuous society. Thank you for listening to Capitol Record.